From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and the Vatican confirms that Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis did meet with the Pope when he was here in the U.S. In a moment, NPR's Sylvia Poggioli will join us on the Pope's secret agenda during his U.S. visit.
But first, Russia is now conducting airstrikes in Syria. Earlier today, Russian officials told the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad of the impending strikes and asked the U.S. to stay out of Syrian airspace. Once the strikes began, Russian officials said they were targeting ISIS, but there have been reports that they were actually targeting Syrian rebels. Both the rebels and ISIS fighting to overthrow Syrian President Bashar Assad, Russia's ally. Tom Vandenbroek covers the Pentagon for USA Today. And Tom, do we know what these strikes are targeting?
Well, we know where they're occurring, Robin. And I heard from a senior military official that they're near the city of Homs, which is not an area in which the Islamic State is operating. So that's where the new Syrian forces are. So you have to assume that that's who they're targeting.
Well, and Reuters is reporting that a U.S. official told them that they don't believe that Russia is targeting ISIS. So first of all, how significant is this that there are strikes at all?
Well, it's very significant. I mean, it complicates the issue, obviously, greatly in Syria. If, in fact, Russia is going after new Syrian forces, it serves to prop up Assad, whom we say must go in order for a political settlement to take place there. So it seems to be, and Senator McCain today on the floor of the Senate said it's blindingly obvious what they're doing. They're trying to prop up Assad.
Well, and it's also, as you say, going after these Syrian rebels. People might remember years ago now, that part of the uprising that was trying to overthrow several leaders in the region, the U.S. was backing those Syrians against Assad, but not backing ISIS. What a complicated web we have here.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different groups there. You have new Syrian forces there whom we don't supply weapons to. We have a very, very small group of Syrians that we've trained. I mean, we're talking dozens whom we have trained. And then you've got al-Qaeda-affiliated groups like al-Nusra, and you have ISIS as well.
So how does the U.S., do you think, thread this needle? They want to back Russia, I would imagine, if Russia was actually fighting ISIS, but not if Russia's attacking rebels.
Yeah, they're threading the needle with a cable right now. It's not working very well. Russia seems to be doing what it wants to do there, which apparently is to prop up Assad, and they're asking us not to conduct flights while they're doing that. As it happens, most of the bombing that they're doing right now, the first strikes are in Homs, is in an area where we don't operate. So there's no immediate conflict, but it's not hard to see how that could happen very quickly.
Okay, and what is going to happen as Russia and the U.S. apparently face off now over Syria? But the U.S. is also conducting airstrikes around Kunduz, the town in the north of Afghanistan that was taken by the Taliban on Monday. Now, earlier reports, and we had some yesterday, said these airstrikes were to support Afghan forces who were trying to retake the town from the Taliban. We now know that there are U.S. Special Force troops in Kunduz, and they were sort of hunkered down in an airport with residents. They were stuck there, and the strikes were to protect them and other NATO forces. Just unspool this. I mean, isn't the combat mission supposed to be over in Afghanistan?
Right. There are limited authorities for U.S. forces there. They can train and assist Afghan forces and also conduct counterterrorism missions as well. So presumably these guys were there to, you know, assist Afghan troops. And it's not very many, as I understand it, but clearly not a good situation for them to be in.
Well, and would the, just to clarify, would the U.S. have been able to have these airstrikes if there weren't U.S. troops there? In other words, do we have the authorization to strike at the Taliban in Afghanistan?
We do on occasion at the request of the Afghan government, but it doesn't happen very often, much less more frequently than we're conducting airstrikes in Syria and Iraq right now.
Yeah. Well, and there you have it. Airstrikes by the U.S. in Syria and Iraq and airstrikes by Russia in Syria, and Russia telling the U.S. stand down in Syria because you don't want both U.S. and Russian planes heading at each other over Syria. Just your, in the few seconds we have here, your thoughts on this moment for President Obama.
It's very difficult right now. I mean, you could see very quickly how this could go wrong in Syria if there's anti-aircraft fire that takes down a U.S. or coalition plane, or you know, a Russian pilot goes down and is captured there. Things can go bad in a big hurry.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on all of this. Tom Vandenbroek, who covers the Pentagon for USA Today, as Russia announced earlier and then began airstrikes in Syria. Big difference of opinion as to what they're striking. The Russians say ISIS fighters, but other reports and U.S. officials have said it's believed they're striking Syrian rebels. Tom, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, now to that secret meeting we're learning about today between the Pope and Kim Davis, the Kentucky County Clerk who has refused to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Turns out the two met last week when the Pope was in Washington. Here's Kim Davis talking to ABC News about that meeting.
I put my hand out, and he rushed and he grabbed it, and I hugged him, and he hugged me, and he said, "Thank you for your courage."
Well, the Vatican confirmed the meeting this morning. NPR's senior European correspondent Silvia Poggioli joins us from Rome with more. Hi, Silvia.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And news of this meeting is coming as a big surprise to a lot of people in this country. Why have this meeting in secret between the Pope and Kim Davis?
Well, that's a very good question. I think probably the main reason was so as not to overshadow the visit. Had it been revealed at the time that it happened just before Pope Francis left Washington to go to New York, it probably would have dominated the news cycle, several news cycles, and blocked out all the following papal events in New York and in Philadelphia. The question is whether the Vatican wanted or thought it could keep a lid on the meeting completely. If it did, that was rather naive. But the fact that they are so tight-lipped now does raise some questions.
Well, what are we hearing from the Vatican, if anything? We've heard a little bit from Kim Davis and her lawyer about the meeting, that the Pope gave her two rosaries, that he told her to stay strong.
Yes, he said, hugged her, stay strong. And according to her version, it lasted 15 minutes and she entered, or her lawyer said that she entered the Vatican embassy somewhat secretly on board an SUV and with a different hairstyle. What we're hearing from the Vatican is just about nothing. At first this morning, it neither confirmed nor denied. Then this afternoon, Rome time, the Vatican issued a statement by the Holy See spokesman, Father Federico Lombardi, saying, "I do not deny the meeting took place, but I have no comments to add." That means no more information is expected from the Holy See, not at this point anyway.
So you take that and you add it to the Pope's speech before Congress, and he almost entirely skirted the issue of marriage. He said only, and I'm quoting here from his speech, "I cannot hide my concern for the family, which is threatened perhaps as never before from within and without. Fundamental relationships are being called into question, as is the very basis of marriage and the family. I can only reiterate the importance and, above all, the richness and the beauty of family life." So it's not just that this meeting between him and Kim Davis was kept secret. He seemed to want to skirt that issue of marriage, especially after this big ruling recently from the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, I think in one of his last speeches in Philadelphia, he came a little closer. He talked about marriage being challenged, and he said in social context, and also he said, unfortunately, added this word to his prepared text in the judicial sense. That was as close as he came to a reference to same-sex marriage. But you're right, it was rather evasive. I think this is something he did throughout the trip, though. He never really, he balanced everything. And I think it was further proof that Pope Francis cannot really, the meeting with Kim Davis is further proof that Pope Francis can't be pigeonholed as a liberal. He has things to say that are challenging to both liberals and conservatives. And this is further proof. As I say, we're going to have to really assess in coming days what this meeting meant and how could his visit to the United States be perceived differently. I think it's a little early right now.
Well, you were on the plane back to Rome with him. Does anything sort of crystallize now that you know about this meeting with Kim Davis? Anything that he said on that plane when he spoke to the press, does it look a little bit different now?
Well, you know, he was asked during the press conference if he would support government officials who say they cannot in good conscience discharge their duties, for example, issuing same-sex marriages. The name Kim Davis was never raised. The Pope said, I don't know about all cases, but he was very adamant in talking about the principle, and he said that conscientious objection is a right that is a part of every human. He repeated, it's a right that is part of every human right. I honestly, listening to him at the moment, at first I thought perhaps he was not even aware of the Kim Davis case. Then I started thinking, I said, that's not possible. So now that we know he knew her very well and he had met with her, you know, he was very able in, you know, he fooled us a little bit. And that now we know that he met her. But I think, you know, in terms of also conscientious objectors, Francis singled out two other Americans in his speech before Congress who certainly were rather well known for their conscientious objection, Dorothy Day and Martin Luther King.
Right.
So it isn't just Kim Davis who gets the honors here.
NPR senior European correspondent Silvia Poggioli, who traveled with the Pope as he was visiting the United States and is now back in Rome. Silvia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now, and listen to these statistics. About 60% of men and 50% of women in this country experience at least one traumatic event in their lives, and 7-8% of Americans will develop post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. That's according to the Department of Veterans Affairs, an agency that has to pay a lot more attention to PTSD, because as much as 20% of the Iraq War veterans have PTSD in a given year. How to treat it? Still up for debate, and our next guest thinks he has a good answer. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk is a psychiatrist who's been treating trauma victims for decades. He's the author of the book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. It's out in paperback this month. We spoke in January, and I asked him to define trauma and its symptoms.
Trauma is an experience that overwhelms your capacity to cope. People feel helpless, overwhelmed, scared to death. Horrified. At the core of trauma is horror.
Give me an example of something that would count as trauma.
Seeing your child killed by a car in front of your face. Mm. Being gang raped by a group of people. Seeing your father carted off by the police to jail and not knowing what's going to happen to him. Being taken out of your home in the middle of the night if you're a foster kid and not knowing where you're going and thinking, my life is over.
And of course, the things that we now associate with PTSD, trauma that occurs in war.
Of course. So war always focuses people's attention on trauma because it's so obvious. But for every soldier who develops PTSD in the war, there's about 30 kids in the U.S. who develop trauma-related symptoms because of violence that they experience.
And you worked with veterans back in the 70s when there was no such thing as PTSD, or that's not how we referred to it. What were you seeing then, and how did PTSD finally become a diagnosis?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because what people came in for was saying, I've become a monster. Nobody is safe with me. I blow up at people who I love. I can't feel any feelings for my kids. I try to assault my bedmates in the middle of the night and try to kill them, and suddenly I realize I'm trying to kill my honey. And so it was really an issue of not being able to contain aggression and fear. But then for political reasons, we had to convince the VA that this had to do with the war. So the main focus of the diagnosis became having flashbacks and nightmares, which they also did have. And so it became a memory diagnosis. But in fact, oftentimes when people are in a post-traumatic state, they don't really think about what has just happened to them. Their whole bodies are just in a state of chronic arousal, of being angry, of being upset, being terrified. And it doesn't have much of a content of this is because of a particular reason.
So they're not making a direct connection to the terrible experience that they had during the war and the terrible thing that they are doing at the moment, but they are connected, which brings us to the title of your book, The Body Keeps the Score.
Right. So it's not a story that is bad. The event is over, but your body keeps reacting as if you're back there again. So trauma is being played out in heartache, gut-wrenching feelings, panic reactions, and rage.
So how do we treat that right now? I know that let's go through some of the treatments here. And one of the most common is cognitive behavioral therapy. What is that?
Well, that's helping people to look at what they're experiencing, talk about what they're experiencing, and repeatedly talking about it in such a way that it loses some of its power. It causes some decrease in PTSD symptoms, but only 10, 15, 20%. So it doesn't do as much as you'd wish it would do.
What about exposure therapy?
Exposure treatment only works if your mind and your brain feel safe and you can sort of visit what happened back then from a safe perspective. So if you expose people to the memory of the trauma while they're freaked out, you only freak them out more.
But you have gone into new directions to treat it. And one of the things that you've done is having people do yoga.
Yeah. Our research very clearly sort of pushed us in the direction of yoga. I didn't practice yoga myself. And then we saw all these abnormalities in people's heart rate, their breathing patterns, the way they relate to their bodies. It was very clear is that their bodies were on fire. Their bodies felt deeply unsafe. So the enemy that used to be outside is now living within. You need to befriend your body. You need to calm your body down.
Did that work? Did that have an effect on people with PTSD?
Our NIMH-funded study on yoga showed that yoga was more effective than any medication that has ever been published.
What does that tell you?
It tells us that medication can be quite nice to sort of dampen some of the symptoms, but at the end, people need to own their bodies and need to own their physical experiences. And in order to overcome your trauma, it needs to be safe to go inside and to experience yourself.
We're speaking with Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, author of The Body Keeps the Score. And doctor, you sound like you think there's too much focus right now in the treatment of trauma on the brain and not enough on the body.
In my mind, and brain and body are indistinguishable from us. What there's too much emphasis on is the capacity of the cognitive, rational brain to conquer our irrational survival brain. Neuroscience has helped us to understand that you really cannot talk yourself out of being in love or being angry or hating particular people because these are not rational processes. And reason has only very limited capacities to override these very more primitive survival issues. And so you need to not rely on reason. You need to rely on mastery of your body, safety in your body, finding peacefulness in your body, and that is not something that people learn in their psychology schools, because psychology schools are about understanding and yakking.
Well, speaking of yakking, by the way, one of the things that you have done is gotten people into groups and had them talk about their experience, their traumatic experience. Why do you do that?
Well, in general, I think talking about what's happened to you is important for certain people, namely for people for whom the trauma has become a shameful personal secret. And most traumas are. Most people feel terrible about what has happened to them. They blame themselves for having been raped. They blame themselves for what happened to their kids. They blame themselves for what happened, that their friends got killed in the war. And so trauma oftentimes becomes an issue filled with shame. And learning how to talk about things and to put it out there is a very important part of recovery.
So but what's the difference between that and cognitive behavioral therapy?
The difference is you don't try to manage people's symptoms. You try to help people to find language for basically unspeakable experiences. And that's a very gentle, thoughtful process. But you really do need to help people to just stay and going there and to find words for things that are almost unspeakable. And so one of the pieces of research we did is we showed that when people are remembering their trauma, the speech center of the brain basically goes offline. And people become dumbfounded when they go back to memory, remembering their trauma. And helping to bring that speech center slowly online, very gently, is an important part of treatment.
You know, I had a doctor in New York City who I remember him telling me that he was robbed at gunpoint, shot in his office, and years later, the thing that finally got him to get back to more of a normal life was he became a runner, and he would run all the time, and he started running marathons, and that was the moment when his mind could really relax.
You see, that doesn't surprise me. What I keep running into is that people have experiences like being massaged or by acting in a play or running or being in an athletic activity where they suddenly say, my body feels safe again. Mm. And we don't know what those things are. But sitting in a chair and repeating the story about your trauma over again is probably not going to do it.
What is the one real take-home message, though, that you would want people to read your book and go away thinking that they don't already?
Maybe the most important thing is that we have self-regulatory capacities. We have an innate capacity to heal from trauma, and that we need to explore what those capacities are and find a way of calming ourselves down. When you're traumatized, your brain continues to react as if you're still in danger. In order to recover from trauma, you need to find a way of feeling yourself, noticing yourself. A good example, I had the chance to talk with Nelson Mandela, and I had the chance to ask him how he explained his having become this extraordinary person. And he said, boxing. Again, like, you don't think about boxing for the treatment of trauma or incarceration. And he said, yeah, boxing helped me aware of what the other person is about to do, made me aware of my own body, helped me to anticipate my own movements and what reaction it would have on other people. Mm-hmm. And when he told me that, I thought that makes perfect sense from a neuroscience point of view. It's not one size fits all. I wouldn't say to everybody, go do boxing, or even to everybody, go do yoga.
But feel that you're in control of your own body.
Yeah, you need to find some way. It may be tango dancing, it may be running, it may be any number of things where your body once again feels like I am in control of myself.
Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, he's the author of The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. Dr. van der Kolk, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we spoke with Dr. van der Kolk in January. His book is now out in paperback. You're listening to Here and Now.
Amazon launched a new delivery service in Seattle this week, paying part-time drivers to deliver packages quickly. It's called Amazon Flex. It's part of Amazon's one-hour Prime delivery service available to Amazon Prime members who pay $99 for a year membership with one-hour shipping costs extra. And Amazon Flex is headed to other cities in the U.S. So what are the up and downsides? Samuel Burke is business correspondent for CNN. Samuel, so what are the qualifications for the drivers?
Well, the qualifications seem very simple, minimal. And in that sense, it sounds a lot like Uber. All a driver needs is a car, a driver's license, and an Android phone, interestingly, not an iPhone. And basically what they can do is actually stay in their neighborhoods and pick up items from locations, not necessarily from warehouses, but locations that might have the typical items and deliver them in that neighborhood and working in short shifts or long shifts, 2, 4, 6, 8, and 12-hour shifts, Amazon says.
Well, they also have to have a background check. And you mentioned Android. And that's one question that people have. That seems to be saying that Amazon feels its app only works well on the Androids.
Well, I think this is happening with a lot of companies. They feel the pressure with Apple. And so they're first, they aim toward Android, and then later on, they tend to go toward Apple. And of course, Amazon has their main consumer app, which is available on Android and Apple.
Okay, so these drivers will make $18 to $25 an hour. What's the downside potentially for Amazon going away from UPS and FedEx and towards this Uber model?
Well, they want to depend on themselves, and that could make them stronger. The downside is what happens if they face the same type of class action lawsuits that Uber is facing in California, trying to turn those part-time employees, or rather contractors, into employees. Now, I'm just looking at the list of places where this Amazon Flex service is going to be available. Interestingly, California, none of the cities there are on this list. So it might be a smart move from Amazon to try and avoid those type of class action lawsuits, at least for now. But it gets into this bigger question about the recovery in the United States. Yes, people are able to get jobs, more so than in the recession, but they're not necessarily the type of jobs that they really want or had before the recession.
Yeah. So questions about what this means for labor, that Amazon's moving towards this model, but also what it means. Well, we were speaking this morning about the environment. If you have a lot of cars running around delivering, you know, rolls of paper towels to people, isn't that not as sustainable as having one delivery truck with 100 rolls in it?
In this case, I think Amazon may have done something very clever, both for themselves, the drivers, and the environment, because it looks like these drivers are going to be sticking to their local neighborhoods for the most part. So hopefully the drivers won't be going too far if they're just driving some toilet paper back to somebody's house.
Well, what about the cost efficiency for Amazon? These drivers are being paid $20 an hour. If they make, you know, 5 deliveries in an hour, that's pretty good for Amazon. If they make just 1 delivery in an hour, then Amazon's just paid $20 to deliver one thing.
Well, it may not be cost efficient for Amazon, but on the flip side, it's good for the drivers in the sense that they're not being paid per ride the way Uber is. And that's the advantage that a lot of these companies with these huge valuations and soaring stock prices have, is that they have a lot of cash that they can plow in now and experiment and see, is this cost efficient? And then if it doesn't work, they can always switch their model. But that's what all that extra cash is good for, for these huge tech companies.
Samuel Burke, business correspondent for CNN. Samuel, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
You've probably noticed an increase in people commuting by bike. There's also been a rise in bike fatalities, especially among people in their 40s and 50s. In 2013, there were 743 cyclist fatalities across the country. Well, maybe your city is responding by creating more bike lanes, or bike lanes with barriers like planters, or maybe there's a sidewalk, then a line of parked cars, then a bike lane, then a cement barrier, then traffic. But bike lanes are controversial. Drivers in Boulder, Colorado complained that they caused traffic backups, so the lanes were removed. And where protected bike lanes are popular, they stop at intersections. And that's where protected intersections come in. It's common in the Netherlands, but no one in the U.S. really got it until a young former video game designer named Nick Falbo made a video that urban planners understood. Here he is describing the main elements.
A corner refuge island, a forward stop bar for bicyclists, a setback bike and pedestrian crossing, and bicycle-friendly signal phasing.
Now, Davis, California has a protected intersection. So does Salt Lake City, Utah. Robin Hutchinson is Salt Lake's transportation director. She joins us now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We also have Jennifer Dill, who heads the National Institute for Transportation and Communities at Portland State University. They're in Portland, Oregon. Jennifer, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And let's start with you, Jennifer. I've been reading about this. I've seen pictures of these protected intersections, and I still can't picture it. So what is a protected intersection?
The whole idea is more and more cities, as you mentioned, are building protected bike lanes. And the more you physically separate that lane, let's say through parked cars or planters, the farther away it is from the moving motor vehicles. The problem is when you get to the intersection and, for example, cars want to turn right, but bicyclists might want to go straight through the intersection, and that's where you have potential conflict. Mm. And a lot of cities so far in the U.S. have dealt with that by what we call mixing zones, which is where the cars and the bikes start to merge somehow to maneuver through the intersection. The idea behind the protected intersection is to continue that protected lane through the intersection, to have a little bit of protection on the corner, some physical protection, but also move the lane further away from the cars.
So there's going to be these stop lines for the bicyclists that'll be ahead of where the traffic is stopped.
The cars are going to be stopped further back. The bicyclists are going to be further in front. And then ideally, you would also separate those movements with traffic signals. So you'd have a special bike signal just for the bicyclist.
So you might, you know, if you're in the car, you're going to be looking at the bicyclists ahead of you, and they can make eye contact.
Exactly. The way it works right now, when you just have a striped lane by the side of the road, a driver might be turning right, and a bicyclist could easily be in their blind spot.
And there's going to be these islands in this intersection?
Yes. This is hard to describe without a picture. So the idea of having this island that comes out further than many of our current intersection corners would, it's really going to slow down the motor vehicle.
This kind of oval-shaped thing that they have to drive around.
Yeah.
Yep, you've got it right. Only ours are football-shaped.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. So Robin Hutchinson there is in Salt Lake. What does that island do? It forces the cars around. So you have moving traffic, island, and then a lane. Is that presumably where bikes would go? In other words, do bikes continue in their bike lane and now this little island is on their left and the sidewalk is on their right?
Yes. And let's say you're bicycling and you're approaching an intersection and you want to make a right-hand turn. You used to have to mix it up with cars and hope that the car can see you. And in many instances, you still do have to do that. But in this situation, you're always protected behind either the curb of the protected bike lane or that football-shaped thing that we have out there that won't allow cars into that space. So you can take a free right without ever interfering with car traffic, and vice versa. Great for drivers, too. Drivers can completely predict where the bikes are going to be and where they're going to go now.
What about the bikes that are going straight? You said that they pull ahead of the cars at the stoplight. But if it's a green light, if they're sailing down and don't see somebody turning right, I mean, how does this help that kind of a fatality when a cyclist is going straight and the car's turning? Is it just that it slows the car's turn down?
It definitely does that. I would recommend in a situation where you have high volumes of right-turning cars and high volumes of bicyclists going straight, that you have a separate signal phase for the bicyclist. So the bicyclist going straight would have a green light, and the cars turning right would have a red light.
Okay, so Robin, you're going to have the grand opening later this month for your city's protected intersection. This is downtown. You're doing this, but I've been to Salt Lake, frequently love it. Oh my gosh, people ride their bikes there. But your roads, compared to some of the roads back east, are a mile wide. You know, you can put these football-shaped little islands a few feet from every curb.
They're not quite a mile wide, but they are wide. And that offers us some opportunity, but it is also a pretty big problem when it comes to pedestrian and bicyclist safety. People on bikes and people walking are faced with higher speed traffic. The longer distance you can see, the more likely the car is going to be speeding. So we have real challenges, especially at our crossings. Crossing these wide streets takes a long time. You're exposed for a very long time, whether you're on a bike or you're walking. And this is the condition we're trying to treat.
You want more people to ride bikes than drive cars.
Well, there's a couple things happening here. We do have some air quality challenges, especially in the winter and then the dead of summer as well. And 55% of our pollution is produced by mobile source or tailpipe emissions. And so we're responding to really high demand for making it more bicycle friendly. And people are going to ride if they feel safe. And they probably won't if they don't.
On the, oh my God, as I said, tons of biking there. I couldn't believe people biking all the way up to Snowbird up the mountain and then riding their bikes.
A different kind of biking, yes.
Oh, yeah, and riding their bikes back down again, which was astonishing. Yeah. Jennifer Dill, but put this in a national context. Boston is considering it. We have tiny, old, thin streets. And this didn't really catch on until a former video game maker there in your city, Portland, Oregon, adopted an idea from a Dutch designer. What happened?
Nick Falbo, yes. I'm actually proud to say he's a former student of mine from Portland State University, too. And, you know, a design that's been used in the Netherlands for many years because they have a lot of protected bike lanes, and they've been using this intersection design for a while. And he was able to really visualize it and also put it in a U.S. context in a very simple 5-minute video that shows how it could work. And it's great that there's cities out there like Salt Lake City that are going to be trying it out. And I think one of the things that we're doing at the center that I run is we're about to start a research project where we'll be evaluating these types of intersections in the U.S. to see how well they do work.
Well, and in some cities, there's been really fierce resistance. So, Robin, what are your critics saying where you are?
Well, we've certainly had our share of critics, and especially the first time we tried the protected bike lane on 300 South, we had a lot of folks that were pretty concerned about what it would do. There is always a trade-off in transportation. And on that particular corridor, we reduced the amount of parking by about 30%. And that was very difficult for people. But we've worked with them. And while there are still some businesses on that corridor that are upset, many, I would say, have learn to really accept and even like the protected bike lane. In fact, we recently released a progress report, just key measures, and it shows that business is up on that corridor.
But Jennifer, how does this come to a city like Boston or other East Coast cities, Philadelphia, that I can't imagine where you'd put the island?
It will be tricky. The smaller your intersection, it's going to be trickier, particularly if you have a lot of heavy vehicle, large vehicles making those turns. You may not be able to employ all aspects of the design. For example, perhaps not the island part of it. But there's other parts of it that perhaps you could implement. In particular, the separate bike traffic signal phase for bicyclists, if the volume of cyclists warrants it.
That's Jennifer Dill of the National Institute for Transportation and Communities at Portland State University. We've also been speaking with Robin Hutchison, Transportation Director for Salt Lake City. Robin, Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And by the way, student Nick Falbo is now senior planner at Alta Planning and Design there in Portland, Oregon. You can see his video of a protected intersection as well as a picture of the Salt Lake City version at hereandnow.org. So what do you think? Protected intersections, they've been put in a new development in Austin, Texas, but they haven't been used there yet. And a development is different from a downtown. So cyclists, we'd love to hear your thoughts on protected intersections at hereandnow.org.
To muddle or not to muddle? To dip or not to dip? Those are the questions if you're serving Shakespeare-themed cocktails and snacks. And there's a new book by Shakespeare scholars Caroline Bix and Michelle Ephraim called Shakespeare Not Stirred, Cocktails for Your Everyday Dramas. These two have been blogging about the Bard for years on their site Everyday Shakespeare, and they're here now with us. And how did you go from blogging about Shakespeare to coming up with these recipes for food and drinks?
Well, a lot of the time we would get together after work, after getting the kids to bed at a bar. And that's where we would have our time to hang out. And we love joking, laughing, talking about Shakespeare over a good cocktail. And then it just came to us. Well, of course, this is what we have to do.
We're also great fans of creating recipes and new cocktails, mm-hmm. and the two things just naturally came together.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you used that word create, because these are not things that Shakespeare himself actually ate or drank.
No, but we think he would love them.
Yes.
Okay. If he could time travel.
Okay, well let's talk about some of them here. And one of them is called The Drowning Ophelia. Of mm-hmm. course, the character from Hamlet. Is that one of these mm-hmm. ones in front of me right here?
That would be the blue drink
with the floating flowers.
Edible. Okay. Edible flowers.
Should I try this right
sure,
now? I can
it.
Only have a tiny bit because, you know, sure. it's the middle of the day. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, that's delicious. Okay, yeah. So tell me what's in that. It's got a very kind of lemony tang.
Yes, yeah. So it has fresh lemon juice, it has curacao, it has vodka, and it has a little bit of Saint Germain and elderflower liqueur.
And what about these flowers that are floating in the top of it?
Edible flowers.
Those are dusted with sugar and egg white. Yeah. Mm. And look beautiful and taste delicious.
And they're a nice tribute to Ophelia, who is often shown drowning with her flowers surrounding her. But we wanted to make her this drink before she went down.
All right. And what are these other ones that we've got in front of us here?
This bright red one is made with cherries, and it's Juliet's emoji toe, which is a play.
Explain that.
On the emojito. So she's in our chapter on recapturing your youth. And we thought she really represented she's the iconic vapid teenager who has so many torturous emotions, but she can't get them out. She's stuck in iambic pentameter. And we thought, well, if she were today living, she would have just loved to spew out on social media. So we made her the emojito.
I'm picturing like Taylor Swift Juliet.
Exactly.
Okay, let me try
this one.
And
you know she wrote that Romeo and Juliet song.
Right. Taylor She's Swift. Picturing herself.
That's right.
As
oh,
that as
that's
well.
Delicious.
Yes.
And the mint in that
yeah,
is
so
really
that's
great.
Mint, cherries, of course, because
cherries.
It is.
Why hasn't Juliet. Anybody made that drink popular in bars?
Well,
maybe now they will.
Yes.
Okay, and we have one more here
yes.
that's kind of a lemon.
This is our
thing.
Kate's Shrew Driver. So this is Kate from The Taming of the Shrew. And she,
it's
you know, do you want to describe this one, Michelle?
Sure.
Actually,
yes.
I'm going to top this off with some grapefruit bitters.
You've
because
got some grapefruit bitters.
She's
right
a bitter, here. Bitter character. So
okay.
give her a little dash.
Well, she
that.
Has this speech at the end of the play. Where she tells women to place your hands below your husband's foot as if she's being totally obedient. But of course, that moment can be played in many different ways as winking, ironic, sarcastic.
Right. That's very good. The cocktails are good on their own, even without the Shakespeare backstory.
We worked very hard on making very good recipes.
It was a long winter.
Now, we also have some food in front of us.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
what is this?
This is the Motley Fool, and that is spelled F-U-L to refer to the Middle Eastern dip. With fava beans, and of
I'm
course,
dip a little
go
pita.
For it.
In
Please
here.
Do,
yeah, go for
and
it.
Refers to the Motley Fool. The reference of Motley Fool comes from As You Like It. It's a reference to Touchstone, the clown, the fool. He tells everyone the bitter, hard truth about their lives, and everyone's supposed to digest it.
Mm-hmm. You might stir up in an office party.
Yes, exactly.
Where you might give some straight-up truth to your boss.
And right. Bring a little of the bard to the office.
Right, exactly. Right. If you've got some hard truth to tell people, some straight dope that might be hard to swallow, serve it with this.
You know, one of the things I noticed in looking through this book, and I have to say, my father's side of the family comes from very close to Stratford-upon-Avon. So I've got the Shakespearean roots. Mm-hmm. One of the things I notice is how little Shakespeare I actually know, because there are a lot of characters in here that I hadn't even, Taiesa from Pericles?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. We try to include as many characters as possible. Yep. So we have characters that people are very familiar with, Hamlet, Ophelia, but we also have many other characters from all over his work that people can get to know for the first time.
That's right. That was one of our goals in writing this book, too, was bringing Shakespeare, even the lesser-known Shakespeare, to people in an accessible way. So if they wanted to learn a little bit, they could take a little hit and learn a little bit from especially our mini bards.
Yes.
And has it worked out that way? Do you find that people, after drinking the Juliet Imogito, that they go and read up some Shakespeare after that?
Well, we'll see. I hope so.
I hope so. But certainly getting the essence of the characters and some of the rich language of Shakespeare's plays, that's all in our book. So we wanted to deliver all of it to people. Mm-hmm.
And your favorite play is from Shakespeare?
The Winter's Tale.
Okay. And you?
I would say Winter's Tale too, but I'm going to give Macbeth a very close. I'm going to say they're tied.
All right. Well, Caroline Bix and Michelle Ephraim, authors of Shakespeare Not Stirred, Cocktails for Your Everyday Dramas, and Dip, too. And I'm going to try another little bit of this. As we say, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.